You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast on benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH, and overactive bladder syndrome, or OAB, hosted by Med Learning Group. This program will be geared toward urologists and advanced practice providers, or APPs, who manage these conditions. In this episode, we'll be discussing strategies to select appropriate pharmacologic treatments for patients with BPH and OAB to optimize patient outcomes in urology practice based on available guidelines and clinical evidence for these therapies, and design effective management strategies to minimize complications with adverse events associated with BPH and OAB treatments to improve patient safety and adherence. My name is Tara, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Gopal Narang. Dr. Narang is an assistant professor of urology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Medicine. Dr. Narang focuses on the medical and surgical management of BPH, stone disease, and robotic and minimally invasive surgery. Dr. Narang, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Tara, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to chat.
Wonderful. Let's begin with some background on the disease state. What are the mechanisms of disease for BPH and OAB?
So BPH, like you had mentioned earlier, is benign prostatic hyperplasia, and that in its simplest form represents an enlargement of prostatic tissue that therefore makes it harder for men to empty their bladder. And an overactive bladder is a sort of clinical symptom complex that represents urgency, frequency, and urge-associated incontinence. In terms of the mechanisms of these, there's a wide variety of reasons as to why someone would have an enlarged prostate. Some aspect of it could be genetic. Some aspect of it could be inflammatory for maybe chronic bouts of prostatitis. Truthfully, we don't know like the exact mechanism of it, but that enlargement of prostate tissue ends up making it harder for these men to empty their bladder. An overactive bladder is somewhat similar to that. There are multiple reasons. At its root, it comes down to an oversensitivity of the bladder, and therefore these individuals have a lower capacity bladder. Their bladders want them to squeeze more often and to expel the urine, and so therefore they get urgency and sometimes even incontinence.
Interesting. Thank you. What is the symptomatology of these conditions?
So I like to think of these, and when I explain it to patients, almost in like two, I almost think of it as like a Venn diagram, two circles that have some overlap. So BPH predominantly has obstructive symptoms. So that means a weak stream, intermittency, meaning when a man is going to the bathroom, it starts and stops, urinary hesitancy. When he is trying to initiate his void, it's difficult for him to start. That is classic BPH, lower urinary tract symptoms from a big prostate. Now, an overactive bladder has a different symptom complex. I describe these as irritative symptoms. Some will call them storage symptoms. So this is mainly an urgency to go to the bathroom, meaning when someone has to go to the bathroom, it comes on just like that. Urinary frequency, so they're not holding their bladder for multiple hours, but maybe once an hour, even less than an hour, they're feeling that sensation to go to the bathroom. And then incontinence as well, which is usually associated with urgency. So that feeling that they have to go, they're trying to go to the bathroom, but unfortunately they leak on the way. And so there is some overlap. People with BPH can have that urgency and frequency. People with an overactive bladder can have a weak stream. And so there is some overlap between the both.
How do these conditions affect the quality of life for patients? And how can clinicians consider this aspect when building treatment plans?
Both of these conditions can have significant effects on men and women's quality of life. BPH can limit a man's ability to empty his bladder. That in and of itself can cause pain. It can also just affect their ability to do the things that they like to do, whether it's like going out and playing a round of golf and not being able to because you just can't hold it for that long, or that when you do have to go to the bathroom, it takes you a long time. An overactive bladder can similarly do that. There is a large sort of decrease in quality of life for individuals who have urgency, and particularly if they have incontinence. So both of these are benign disease states, but just because they're benign, I don't think it necessarily means that they're any less severe than any of the other disease states that we treat as urologists. They really affect patients' quality of life.
Thank you, Dr. Nari. The management of BPH includes therapies such as alpha blockers and anticholinergic agents as standard of care. How are they typically integrated into treatment plans based on clinical guideline recommendations?
So if we first look at BPH and the treatment of lower urinary tract symptoms from BPH, we generally first start with behavioral modification. And then when we sort of go to pharmacological therapy, alpha blockers, like you mentioned, are really the first line therapy. Many men will sort of know like tamsulosin or Flomax is a pretty like tried and true alpha blocker. And that's our first line to treat the disease state. Now, for an overactive bladder, there's a real importance to doing behavioral modification and bladder retraining up front. But for many people, even though those can improve their symptoms, it doesn't get them to a place where they're happy. And then when they need to sort of step into pharmacological therapy, medications such as anticholinergics or even beta agonists are really the first line therapy. Anticholinergics have been around for a long time, and there's a wide variety of them. And finding the right one for a patient really has to do with, you know, their specific goals, needs, and also the side effect profiles of those medications.
What are a few toxicities associated with BPH and OAB therapies?
Sure. So we'll go to the treatments we just talked about. So for BPH, first-line therapy would be alpha blockers. So alpha blockers work by relaxing the muscles around the prostate and the bladder neck. And a lot of the side effects you get are because of that and also because of a little bit of non-selectivity that these medications have. So common side effects that I talk to patients about when we start an alpha blocker would be orthostatic hypotension, so meaning like dizziness upon standing because their blood pressure drops, flushing, retrograde ejaculation is a really big one to talk about with patients. The relaxation of that prostate and that bladder neck can cause the ejaculate instead of coming out of their penis to actually go into their bladder. And that can actually be very surprising for a man and really affect their sexual function. So those are three really important things to talk about. Interestingly, alpha blockers also are associated with something called floppy iris syndrome, where it actually makes cataract surgery more difficult. So this is one of those odd things that you sort of have to ask a patient when you're starting a BPH medication. I'm like, do you have cataracts? Are you going to have cataract surgery? So those are a few things to talk about in the selective toxicities for alpha blockers. For overactive bladder medications, specifically anticholinergics, they have very typical side effects for medications that are affecting the anticholinergic system. So things like constipation, dry mouth, they can actually make it a bit harder for individuals to go to the bathroom. Therefore, there is a risk of retention. And more is coming out nowadays about some of the mental effects of these medications, particularly their links with foggy thinking and also dementia. So many of the things that we're talking about today affect older individuals. And that's something I'm always really sort of diligent about talking to them about some of these effects, let's just foggy thinking and dementia, because if those do happen, we really want them to stop those medications right away.
Excellent points. Thank you, Dr. Nari. How can clinicians best include patient preference considerations, shared decision-making, and additional patient-specific data when designing treatment selection strategies?
Well, you sort of mentioned it right there, shared decision-making. And for the discussions that I have with patients in clinic, it really is a mutual understanding. I'm trying to find out what the goals are of these patients and also what are their most bothersome symptoms. It's rare that someone comes in with just one symptom. It's usually a myriad of things, right? I'm peeing too frequently. I'm peeing too urgently. My stream is slow. And so I think at its basics, like just understanding what the goals are for this patient and also what's most bothersome to them so you can really target it. That's one thing I do to help point me in a direction so that I can offer them the best treatment strategy. And we just talked about toxicities. Those are things that are going to affect patients significantly. You know, I hope these medications work perfectly for everyone, but in reality, they don't. So making them well aware of what those side effects are, asking them to do a little forecasting, like, would you be okay with these side effects? Like, what happens if we improved your symptoms, but you had a dry mouth or you were constipated? I mean, some people will say like, you know, that would actually be better for me. Other people would say, oh, that made my life a lot worse. So I think understanding goals, understanding what's most bothersome, and then being really honest about side effects and how that may affect patients, that can allow us to find the best medications for them.
Thank you. Excellent. And speaking about adverse events or toxicities, what clinical monitoring strategies can clinicians employ to mitigate them based on clinical guidelines? And why is clinical monitoring important for patients with these conditions?
So clinical monitoring is important because for many patients, like I said, these medications work, but there's a large subset of patients where they don't, and it requires us to either change to a different therapy or to progress them along the treatment algorithm. So I think the first step in mitigating all of this is close follow-up, having patients come back in an interval that is not too long so that we can say, all right, you gave this medication like a faithful try. Is it working? Is it not working? For me, it's usually about 6 weeks. If they're going to try a medication, at 6 weeks, I'm going to be able to see if they've had some improvement or not. And I see many patients in clinic who come back who've had, you know, 3, 4, even 6 months between them starting a medication and then seeing someone back. And I think that's a bit of a disservice to them. So the first step in that is going to be just having close follow-up. Another way to sort of mitigate toxicities, particularly if we just look at the anticholinergics, you know, these medications, their side effects are pretty significant. And I think really if those side effects are felt by patients, the only way to really mitigate their toxicities is to switch medications. And that's why I'm really excited about beta agonists, mebegron, mirbetriq, sort of coming to market because they provide an alternative treatment strategy for patients that can help them and give them symptom relief, but also limit their side effect and toxicities. So that's kind of how I approach things.
What are you most excited for regarding the future of OAB and BPH management?
In terms of OAB, I'm excited to see sort of a better integration of beta agonists and their integration into the treatment algorithm. I think many of them are just getting approved. We're seeing how they work in women, but also we're learning more and more about how they work with men who have more complex symptomatology since it's going to be OAB plus BPH. So I'm really excited about that. For BPH, there's research being done now to better sort of like phenotype men and their symptoms. And by understanding those different sort of symptom phenotypes with BPH, maybe we can find which men are going to be better off with medications, which men, you know, medications aren't going to work and they're going to need a surgical therapy. So that's, I think, what's a bit on the front line and what is exciting for me.
Thank you, Dr. Narang. Fantastic. Did you have any additional comments or thoughts before wrapping up?
You know, BPH and an overactive bladder, these are things that affect a large proportion of patients. As men get older, the sort of prevalence of BPH increases. And also, as folks get older, the prevalence of an overactive bladder increases as well. So for the practicing urologists, this is, you know, a bit of bread and butter. And so I think it sort of behooves us to really like dive into both of these disease states and understand all that we can about treating our patients and treating them well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Narang. This has been absolutely wonderful. I'm glad we were able to discuss strategies for optimizing management for patients with BPH and OAB based on clinical evidence, mitigating potential adverse events, and the potential role for combination regimens to maximize outcomes for patients. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully, you'll be able to tune in to other podcasts and educational programming offered by MedLearning Group. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Sumitomo Pharma America, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Have a great day.